Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been almost 20 years since the New Hampshire Supreme Court issued its Claremont ruling on education funding. The decision said all children had a right to an adequate education no matter where they lived. It stemmed from a lawsuit brought by a group of property-poor towns who couldn't afford to provide for their kids' schools as well as wealthier communities could. When the court agreed with them, many state leaders predicted a major shakeup. Here's then-State Senator Jim Rubins, chair of the Education Committee, speaking on The Exchange right after the decision.
This is a change of such moment that the legislature should not be compelled to rush. Article 28 of the Constitution suggests the legislature, only the legislature, sets tax policy. This decision would, in essence, mandate a broad-based tax, and it would result in a significant reduction in local control over local schools.
Others echoed what Rubin said at the time, sparking two decades of legal action, statehouse debates, bills, laws, spreadsheets, and proposals for constitutional amendments. But now, 20 years later, a new report finds very little has changed. And today in The Exchange, we will look at that. School funding then and now. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Gary Reno, author of Distant Dome, a Manchester Inc. link, an in-depth NH.org column about state news. He formerly worked as a reporter for the Union Leader. Also with us, Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, which put out the report I just referenced. Guys, welcome both of you. And Steve, let's do a little back to the future if we could. How big a deal was that decision in December of 1997?
Well, it was momentous, as I think Senator Rubin said. It was a moment. At that time, the state was contributing about $100 million to education. And this opened the door to a conversation about just how much of an obligation is it for the state to take on here? Is it $200 million, $300 million, $400 million, $500 million, $600 million? And really, that's been the debate ever since.
How much?
Not that we do have an obligation, just how much?
Well, I had a good time yesterday getting ready for the show because I went back to 1997 and I listened to all sorts of news conferences and the Exchange show that we did. And Gary Reno, one of our guests on that show, said this is a political bombshell.
Oh, it certainly was. I mean, it blew up the state political system in a lot of ways. But Steve said it was a momentous change. I think the earlier decision was really the momentous one. This one, if you knew the inside and how things worked, they'd already set the stage for this one.
Earlier in the 90s.
A 93 decision that basically said it's a constitutional right. A student has a constitutional right for an education and the state has to pay for it. And if you know the Constitution, you have the provision, which is that taxes have to be equal and proportional. And we all knew what happened, what property taxes were like then. If you lived in Newcastle or Rye or Newington versus Claremont or Berlin or Newport, they were just miles and miles apart. And so you could almost see this decision coming.
Well, and we're definitely going to get into, for most of the hour, reaction thoughts on, Steve, your recent report saying very little has changed. But Gary, at the time, it was a political bombshell. We heard Senator Rubins in that clip saying this opens the door to a broad-based tax. He was not the only one making that prediction, but it didn't happen. How come?
Well, I think what happened was there was a lot of hand wringing going on, but essentially it came down to an income tax and expanded gambling initially. There were like seven or eight different plans were proposed the first year out. But these two were the two that were really competing. And while an income tax passed the House and the Senate, it wasn't the same bill. And that fell under the weight of threatened veto from Governor Shaheen. And then the House just plain out and out refused to go along with expanded gambling. And then that's when we got to the plan that was first developed, which is largely based on a statewide property tax, statewide utility tax, and then upping a whole bunch of other taxes, particularly business taxes, tobacco tax, to come up with the money. But most of the money actually came from the statewide property tax, which is like putting money from one pocket into the other.
Well, and can you just, for our listeners, Steve, please explain how this works, a statewide property tax versus a local property tax, and how on paper it looks like a lot of money, but in reality, it's kind of a lot of that money stays locally.
It's all retained locally. It's raised locally and retained locally, but it goes through the books of the state. And so it is, I think it was the magic trick of the late 90s, early 2000s, that made the state's contribution to the education appear much higher than it actually was. I think we came up with an additional $340 million in actually state dollars that went to this aid, which still represented, you know, less than 30% of the total that was being spent at the time. So that property tax, it's raised locally and it's retained locally.
So looking at your report, Steve, again, you say very little has changed. Before we get into the details, just how surprising is that, given 20 years and given all the political energy that Gary described that went into this?
Well, what sort of surprised me is that anyone's surprised. It's not as if haven't known this to be the case all along. And this was a piece of work that we did just a refresher. Keep it on the table that, you know, in fact, if the goals of Claremont II, which was the late 1990s court case, was to lower the variation in property tax rates and the variation in per pupil expenditures, it didn't accomplish its goal. And if that was, you know, we've always sort of known that, we've been saying it all along, but we're just reminding policymakers that that's the case, that the property poor towns are having a very hard time meeting their obligations with their existing resources, even though we've targeted aid effectively throughout the state.
Go ahead, Gary.
And as Steve's report points out, I mean, there was when they first made the change, there was a significant sort of catch-up that did go on, largely because of the statewide property tax. When you equalize that, then all of a sudden that makes a big difference. But with every change in the tax since that time, we've moved a little bit closer to the way it used to be.
So, in other words, that means on the ground that, you know, people in Berlin have to kick in a lot more in terms
money.
Of property taxes to fund their schools than people in Bedford.
Well, right. It's not so much more money, but rather that their property tax rates have to be so much higher in order to raise money, because the system has effectively targeted cities and towns like Berlin. They've got more per student than, say, a Bedford does. But nonetheless, it hasn't been sufficient to really equalize those property tax rates.
Okay. And one of the things that's really important to look at, given this 20-year sort of retrospective that you guys have done, Steve, is that today there are a lot fewer kids of school age. So, you know, your average person might say, you know, hey, there's fewer kids. So doesn't that mean schools need less money?
Right. And the surprising part of this work from our perspective was, and we shouldn't have been surprised, is that in fact the state's commitment to education at the local level is declining now and will decline because we pay on a per student basis and the number of students is declining. And so explicitly or implicitly, the legislature has made a decision that they are going to reduce their support for public education. And then, you know, given the way the formula is going to work out.
So doesn't that make sense, though? Fewer kids, fewer costs. If it costs X to educate a certain child and all of a sudden there's 20 fewer kids, then
absolutely, it
do
does.
The math.
Of course, it comes down to what your goals are. If we have, you know, a system or, you know, people are concerned about K through 12 education or workforce, you might want to use those resources for something else. For example, in the original part of the budget conversation, I suggested the decline in aid going to local communities could be used to fund kindergarten, for example. But it had been used to that decline in the budgeted amount had already been used to fund other things. So it really comes down to what the goals are of the legislature. The other piece of this, which I think is important, is because those communities are in our rural parts of the state are losing their enrollment more quickly than other parts, they are going to be really financially hurt by the existing formula in ways that will make it hard for them to transition their schools into new, whatever right size that, you know, those new schools are. So I think what our piece really does is ask the legislature again, what are the goals of this? Demographics have changed for the state since you originally created this formula. What should we be doing if your goals have changed over that time period as well?
Sure, what you guys call a new education normal. And we'll definitely pick up on that, Steve. Go ahead, Gary.
And I think there is something, education has changed a great deal, public education in the last 20 years as well. And we're seeing a lot more emphasis on, well, and actually the decision has actually helped push this things in this direction on special education and 504s, which is the disabilities. And these are much more expensive programs than they used to be. And that's one of the reasons we're seeing that the cost of education isn't really going down. It's going up.
So we did a whole program based on some fine NHPR reporting by Casey McDermott. Schools as social workers, they're being asked more and more to pick up the costs of, you know, kids who, my goodness, their children, their parents may be drug addicts or they have special needs and so forth. So there are those costs, Gary.
Personally, my wife just retired as a high school guidance counselor at Newport High School. So, we see this is a conversation we have over the dinner table an awful lot.
Well, the cost of technology, too, have changed a lot since the 90s. Now you've got Chromebooks and iPads and everything in the schools.
This is the conundrum that many of these communities face. There are fixed costs, and if you lose 5 students, you still have all those fixed costs. But if you lose 20 students, you maybe don't have as much fixed costs. How do you help those communities transition to a smaller size?
What's the threshold?
That's right.
Let's go to the phones. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tim is in Portsmouth. Hi, Tim. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi there.
Good morning, Tim. Go ahead.
I grew up in Hampton, and I'm a kind of an elderly gentleman, so I can talk about the past pretty readily. And I'll talk about when my mom in the Hampshire State Legislature about 30 years ago, and she said to me one day, she said, Tim, only Mississippi spends less money on education than New Hampshire. So I was wondering how we were doing, and pertinent to the subject of your discussion today, I looked it up just a few minutes ago in the last year I could find, the most recent year I could find was 2014, and it was, once again, individual per pupil education. And you guys just discussed the little glitch that's involved there when funding is based on per pupil. But the good news is we're up to 10%.
10%, so, meaning?
Number 10. We're at number 10.
I see. Okay, in terms of ranking. So are those rankings useful, Steve Norton? Because, you know, in general, New Hampshire students perform pretty well compared to other states.
Right. So the big difference between us and the rest of the country is that we spend a lot more than most other states on education on a per pupil basis as both local and state. We have higher performing kids. The state contributes much less. That's really the point that he's making. And that's been an explicit policy decision. It is local control. And if you want local control, then the locals are going to pay for it.
I want to bring another voice into our conversation, gentlemen. Somebody who's been watching this issue for a long, long time. John Tobin is on the line, a lawyer who was part of the team that brought the Claremont lawsuit that we're looking at. And John Tobin, good to have you. Welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, very happy to be here.
How do you view this report by Steve Norton's group showing that the system really hasn't changed much in 20 years?
Well, I think the report is really helpful, and I give Steve and Greg Bird at the center a lot of credit for putting this issue back in the public discussion. I guess what I would say is I take the long view, and as Steve mentioned a couple of minutes ago, when the case started, the state was putting in $100 million or less toward education. Now, even setting aside the property tax, it's spending more than $500 million. So that's progress, but it's just not enough. And my view is we need to, what the report hopefully will do is get us all back to work to try to figure this out. And there's a new commission that the legislature set up to take another look at adequacy. So we've made some progress, but we didn't really change the way that education is funded. And that left in place a system that really cripples the towns that were the part of the heart of the Claremont case and the towns that Steve's report illuminates.
So you gave us some
really catch up.
You gave us some numbers there, John, and it sounds like a big increase in state spending on public education. So have we seen the improvements in educational quality that, you know, you would hope for, that you might expect out of that increased spending?
Well, I'm not sure that the issue was ever quality, as Steve said a minute ago. We do a good job. I think a lot of these districts, the people are heroic of, they're doing really well with limited resources. But right now, local taxpayers pay for about 60% of the cost of education, and the state pays 33%. And if you put that much of a burden on local taxpayers, then you fall into the situation that some districts are wealthy and they can handle that easily. Some have far fewer resources to tap, so they must tax themselves at a really high rate. That's the unfairness, and that's what needs to change. And
well, and John, if I could ask you a question on that, just picking up on what you said, the rap against the Claremont ruling for a long time, and you know this better than anybody, is that it does not allow the state to target aid to needier districts. As you said, you know, the wealthier districts maybe don't need state aid. So for a long time, there's been this dispute over, you know, let's overturn this thing with a constitutional amendment, and then we can target those districts that need the help the most. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. No constitutional amendment that's ever been proposed actually would do that. And if you look at the most recent one that I did look at again after the BIA said they were supportive of it, if you look at it, it actually is a permanent hall pass for the legislature. What it says is they have complete discretion about what they do, including to do nothing or very little. It doesn't say anything, and none of them have ever said there is a duty to provide targeted aid. What the amendments do, what they've always proposed to do, is just give the legislature discretion in the hope that there might be targeted aid.
Well, and we'll talk to the BIA a little bit later in the hour. You know, I'd love your thoughts too, John, on what we just discussed with Gary and Steve. The number of school-age children is going down. It's very different from what it was 20 years ago. At what point can you make the argument that schools need less money because they have fewer kids?
I think that Steve just talked about that very cogently. The schools have fixed costs, and if each classroom loses one kid, then the costs don't go down very much. And I think in lots of ways, this argument really isn't necessarily about the dollar amount spent. It's how it's raised and how the burden is apportioned among the state's parents and homeowners and taxpayers.
I see. So it's not so much about how much money, it's who's kicking in and is that fair?
Right. And, you know, in a declining over time, in a declining enrollment situation that persisted for a long time, school districts would have to downsize, and they already are. Mm-hmm. Schools are closing and things like that. But, you know, the places that the report illuminates, Berlin and Claremont, not only do they have more rapidly declining enrollments, they still have this property tax system that makes it hard for them to raise money.
Well, and we are going to talk after a short break, actually, to the superintendent in Claremont. But last question for you, please, John, real quick. If this issue were to end up before the state Supreme Court again, how confident are you that it would rule in your favor like it did the last time, 20 years ago?
Oh, I wouldn't want to speculate on either of those suppositions. I think the constitutional principles have been established, though. We now understand the state has a duty to pay for education, and whatever it uses to pay for it, the rate has to be uniform across the state. So those principles stand.
Okay. John, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
That's John Tobin again. He was part of the team, the legal team that brought the Claremont lawsuit 20 years ago. Coming up, we will speak to the superintendent of schools in Claremont, and we'll keep taking your questions and comments about education funding then and now. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Keep it right here.
A young man and woman fall in love while traveling across Europe in Joseph Monninger's new novel, but he says making that seem interesting on the page is not that easy.
Being in love isn't really that interesting. It's the before and after that really kind of brings the impact.
I'm Peter Biello. Joseph Monninger and I speak about his new book and writing about love on The Bookshelf from NHPR. Find this and all of NHPR's podcasts wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, paying for public schools. A new report finds little has changed over 20 years since the state Supreme Court handed down its Claremont decision on education funding. Join us with your questions or comments about how the state approaches public school funding now, what changes you have seen over the past 20 years since this landmark ruling. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, Steve Norton and Gary Reno, a little bit more about this issue, please, of targeting. Again, Steve, the rap against the Claremont lawsuit from people who didn't like it has always been, look, it ties our hands. We can't target aid to those neediest districts. Why should we give Hollis or Bedford state money when, you know, Berlin and Allenstown are struggling?
Right. So, every formula that has ever been produced tries to send resources to those schools that have more difficult to educate populations or have more difficulty raising money, right? So every formula from the Augenblick formula all the way through the existing one, and they've done it in different ways across the history of these formulas. But to give you an example, Berlin receives over $9,000 in state aid per student, and you compare that to Bedford, which gets $2,000. So it is targeting.
So it sounds like it's doing a pretty good job targeting
to
the neediest
areas.
Well,
that's the question. What's a good job? Should Bedford be getting any money from the state, given its capacity to raise resources? Is that the $9,000 enough for Berlin as it transitions from, you know, a bigger community to a smaller community? So it's not that it doesn't target. It's just a question of how much does it want to target, and are you really willing not to give money to the Bedfords and those other, you know, communities that have significant assets in terms of property.
And Gary, listening to Steve talk reminds me of what we used to talk about, the spreadsheet wars.
Oh,
every
yes.
time the legislature would come up with a new formula, you know, there were some obvious outliers like Bedford and Berlin, but then there are people right. in the towns in the middle, you know, Concord. Okay, it's got a lot of property wealth, but it also has a lot of, you know, children from who speak other languages, has, you know, pockets of poverty. So it's interesting.
Well, when you talk about the spreadsheet wars, it reminds me that it's kind of hard to imagine how all the paper companies went out of business when we were spreading the paper around like we were in the late 90s. But every plan that was ever produced had a spreadsheet with it. And, I mean, they would be distributed to 424 people in the legislature and all of us in the press room and everywhere else. And the
published
first
lists of winners and losers under Senator so-and-so's plan.
Every lawmaker did was look at what happens to my district.
Mm-hmm.
And which is fine. I mean, we got to take care of our own district. But what got lost, I think, was this idea of the greater good. Maybe your district doesn't need that much money. Are we looking at a greater good if we spread the money around to other places? And that's what got lost. And I think what we saw here was kind of a little bit of a beginning, what we're seeing now more in a political process where we're focusing on how does it affect me more than what's better for the state, what's better for the country.
Go ahead, Steve.
And this is it's different this time in the sense that if you put a map on the wall of New Hampshire and you show all those communities that are potentially financially struggling in their efforts to educate the students, it's a big part of the state. Big, wide swaths of rural New Hampshire are already in some cases in crisis because of changes in demographics. And so the very nature of our goals might have to change to reflect regional as opposed to town interests or rural as opposed to non-rural interests. Our cities are also struggling with this. Manchester is seeing declines in enrollment, Nashua. How are they going to deal with these financial changes? They're generally more wealthy in terms of property tax, but they're almost a class of individuals that can think about this problem together. So I think I remember the spreadsheet wars. Doug Hall was a primary.
We all remember the spreadsheet wars.
I think this is a different era that there's, you know, there are big public policy questions now about large parts of New Hampshire that are the same. that the people's goals are going to be the same. How do you help rural New Hampshire transition is not just about Jackson or Berlin or Gorham or even, you know, Claremont or parts out in Keene. It's that whole group that are dealing with it.
But at the same time, we kind of have to overlay what's been going on for the last 20 years, which is every school district wants its own SAU unit or school administrative unit. We've been trying to, we've kind of been localizing. And I mean, it's because, that's one of the reasons also that costs have not gone down.
So if schools consolidated more, form these consolidated regional districts, there's a cost savings.
No, I mean, they're more individual districts than consolidated.
Right.
And so now we have to go the other way, basically.
To consolidate.
Yeah.
To save money. If there are fewer kids in a lot of these rural towns, then they all need to band together. Steve, you're shaking your head.
Just consolidation. I mean, we're looking at what happened in Maine. They forced consolidation. They're forcing it in Vermont. Consolidation is not going to be the answer to this. There are communities in Vermont now that are voting not to consolidate and to eat the costs and the, you know, the penalties associated with that. So there has to be some new thinking about, you know, our public policy around education.
Well, I think back to Alf Jacobson, who used to be a legislator in New Hampshire. He was a state senate president for a while. One of the things he did, even before the Claremont lawsuit, was to put in a bill that would have made the entire state of New Hampshire, every school in it, part of the same administrative unit.
Wait. One giant SAU the whole state?
Local.
Right. And that way, you know, you save on a lot, and you have a lot of synergies and all that. And if you really want to deal with this issue of inequality and opportunity, it's one way to deal with it.
Yeah, I'm sure that went over like a lead balloon.
Yeah. That's the only way that you would really save money is if you did something like that.
Let's go back to our listeners, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. 20 years after the Claremont ruling that was supposed to blow up our system of education funding, a recent report finds not that much has changed. We'd love your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Andrew's calling us from Keene. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
I was wondering, what role, if any, does federal funding play in the situation that your guests are discussing?
It's a good question, Andrew. Thank you. Steve, do you know?
Relatively small. I mean, there are lots of requirements, especially around special education and other things. I think if you talk to the education community, they would say they're required by the federal government to do X, Y, and Z around special needs populations, and they don't get the resources for it. It represents a relatively small share of the overall expenditures as well.
An unfunded mandate.
Correct.
Is what people call it. Gary, do you want to jump in?
There is some federal money, but by compared to what the state and the local taxes contribute, it's very small.
Andrew, thank you for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email that came in from Kathy in Manchester. I'm a home-owning baby boomer looking at retiring in a few years. She says, I'm one of those people who make New Hampshire the second oldest state in the country. Kathy says, I hear that young people are not interested in buying homes. I wonder if at some point in the near future, the lion's share of the financial burden for schools and city services is going to rest on the shoulders of people who are on Social Security. Even if your mortgage is paid, Kathy says, retirees are still paying $500 to $1,000 a month for property taxes. What can we do? Kathy, thank you for the email. Steve, this is a comment that has come up a ton over the last 20 years that, retirees are going to be kicked out of their homes by ever-increasing property taxes. Have we seen that actually happen?
I haven't seen it happen yet. And I think it's still up in the air about whether young people want to buy houses or not. I mean, certainly a 27-year-old millennial doesn't want to buy a house yet, but they might when they're 32. One thing we do know is that they don't want to buy the same types of houses. So, you know, there's definitely change coming. My crystal ball on that one is pretty broken.
Well, but you did do a report, gosh, a couple years ago that was so interesting, basically saying our current housing stock is kind of like that pair of pants that doesn't quite fit right anymore.
That's correct.
So big old houses and millennials don't want to buy those, but that doesn't mean they don't want to buy it all.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the interesting parts about aging in New Hampshire and the property taxes, the state requires that there be property tax exemptions for those over the age of 65. And some communities have created big, exemptions. What are they going to do and how does that impact, school funding, I think, is a question that's going to come our way.
All right. Well, I want to bring another person into our conversation, guys, who, again, has been involved in this for a long time. Middleton McGoodwin is with us, superintendent of schools for the Claremont School District. And Middleton McGoodwin, welcome. Really good to have you.
Well, thank you very much. Very pleased to be talking with you today.
Well, given that your district is sort of the signature of this Claremont lawsuit that we're looking at, what's your reaction to this report from the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies that really not much has changed?
Oh, it's very, very pleased to read this report, but also very, very troubled. The fact is, I'm beginning my 48th year in public education, very, very proud to have the energy, enthusiasm to work with some great teachers and some really outstanding students in a community that has its challenges but doesn't use it as an excuse. But the reality or the elephant in the room is that zip code and tax rate, those two components, are impacting opportunities for students. Where a child lives should not determine the quality of their public education. You know, in our country, everyone should have the opportunity to get ahead. Everyone should have the opportunity to a free and appropriate education. But in truth, in New Hampshire, as well as other parts of our country, where a child lives determines their future. And
how much more money does Claremont receive from the state per child today than it did 20 years ago?
It basically is on my understanding is that there was quite a large gap back in the 1990s, and that gap was closed. But over time, that gap now has widened quite a bit. And it's widened because the state is unable to access revenue to address this gap. Since 1999, property taxes, for example, paid in New Hampshire have more than doubled across the state. That's not a coincidence. It's the state's effort to fund, but the lack of revenue is where the challenge is.
Two different committees are going to be studying education funding over the summer and fall, as I'm sure you know as a superintendent, one from the legislature, one from the Education Department. Have you been asked to participate in either of those?
I have not been directly asked, but I have, along with my fellow superintendent, gone to Concord and have testified during the past 2 years regarding adequacy aid. I do know that the commissioner, as well as the state legislatures, very, very dedicated, caring people. But in truth, they're wrestling with an elephant in the room, and the elephant in the room is inadequate revenue. And as I call the zip code effect, and when you look at student enrollment, and student enrollment is a big factor that caused this change in adequacy aid. Communities were seeing an increase in enrollment, but they weren't receiving the type of revenue they expected. So what was happening was that the revenue shift occurred, and so certain communities like the Claremont School District started to see a massive reduction in adequacy aid. One example would be that in 2 years ago, we had almost $500,000 reduction in adequacy aid.
Wow, that's a lot of money for a small school district.
It is, but here's the thing that's important is that we're not sitting back and expecting the state to just pour in money. But we are asking the state to look at each community, because you just can't look at the community by the number of pupils. You have to look at the demographics. You have to look at the needs of the specific community. In the past 6 years, the Claremont School District budget increased an average of less than 2%.
So you're trying to keep costs down. But address, I'm glad you touched on that, Middleton. You know, you lost $500,000 in adequacy aid in recent years. But are your student numbers going down at the same time? Is there some justification for that reduction in aid?
Well, that's an excellent question. In the past 10 years, the number of students has decreased by 300. But that's where the problem is. You can't look at a school district and just look at the number of pupils, because students in different communities have different backgrounds, have different experiences, have different opportunities. So if you just look at numbers, you're making the assumption that every child, regardless of their zip code, has the same opportunity.
Sure, and I understand that. We talked about that.
That's not correct.
Sure, kids who come from difficult backgrounds and have, you know, learning difficulties or whatever. Still, 300 students, that's a lot.
It is a lot. But when you're talking going from 2,000 to 1,700, 300 sounds like a lot, but you're not finding yourself being able to close schools or save great funds by that reduction in students. You know, the one thing that I think is very, very important when we talk about a community like Claremont, I'm not a politically wise guy. I don't think politics and education really mix, but I can tell you straight out, in my 6 years in Claremont, beginning my seventh year, the type of students I see, the value of education that the community has, supporting children, providing for children the best they can, is remarkable. 5 years after the 2008 economic implosion in our country, the Claremont community approved a $12.5 million bond to renovate a very, very troubled high school. Meaning out of compliance, right?
And lots of local support
but without a dime of state aid.
Mm.
So that speaks about the Claremont community. We don't consider ourselves victims, but as an advocate for public education, the playing field is level. I'm not asking, let's take funds from another community. I'm asking the legislature and the state to not look at communities only by numbers.
Only by the enrollment numbers.
Yeah. It's more than numbers. Here's an example of inadequacy or the lack of equity. 20 minutes down the road from Claremont, there's a wonderful community. They have fewer schools. They have fewer students. Their budget is $10 million more. Now, I have no interest in taking those funds. That's that community. It's wonderful. But when I have teachers, we hire good people, and we try to support them with mentoring. But when these fine educators leave and go to another district and have an increase in compensation, and I'm not exaggerating, $15,000 to $24,000 increase.
Yeah, it's enough. It's hard to refuse. Middleton, I'm going to let you go, but I really appreciate your thoughts today, and we'll check back in with you as these commissions and committees and so forth look at education funding, because it's real interesting. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. That's Middleton McGoodwin, again, superintendent of the schools for the Claremont School District. Wow, Gary, some real passion there for the dedication of, you know, that struggling district to its kids. But, you know, you can't help but make the comparison to the nearby district that has a lot more money, pays teachers better. You know, we've heard this in the Concord area, too. You know, I think some of the poorer towns around Concord lose teachers to the Concord district, which pays better.
Oh, I mean, it's a problem all across the state. I mean, Claremont is a very typical community, and that, you know, has had its rough time, a very rough time raising the money to educate its children. And it was once a very thriving community, and it's no longer that. It's reinventing itself, but what hasn't reinvented itself is the education system.
Go ahead, Steve.
The rural United States is struggling with this.
This is a broader national theme,
Claremont. And, you know, legislators are maligned for this system. It has targeted aid to those communities. Claremont gets more than Bedford. It has increased over time. The question is, I think, more not whether it's good or bad, but is it still sufficient in this new demographic environment? And are there things that the state needs to be doing to help Claremont and other rural areas transition to smaller size? What are those policy levers, and what are the principles upon which you're going to move those policies forward?
Okay, so after the break, let's get into this new education normal, because that's where you're going, Steve, I can tell. Also, we're going to talk briefly with the Business and Industry Association. Dave Juve will be with us to give his perspective. All that's coming up, plus your calls, so stay with us.
The cat sat on the mat. I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work?
Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, paying for public schools. A new report looks at how much has changed in the nearly 20 years since the state Supreme Court's Claremont ruling. It finds that not that much has changed at all. The Exchange number for you to join us with your comments, questions, personal experiences with how education is funding in this state, largely through local property taxes, is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Steve Norton, Gary Reno, I want to turn now to Dave Juve. He's Senior Vice President of the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire, another group that has been looking at this education funding issue for a long time. Dave, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you're welcome. And the BIA has said in a release after Steve's report came out saying that the study makes it very clear Claremont is not working. That's a quote there. What do you mean by that, Dave?
Well, I think the original court cases, Claremont's one and then Claremont two, were arguing that children, grade school age children in New Hampshire were at a disadvantage, an educational disadvantage based on geography, based on what towns their families happened to live in. Claremont, the Claremont decisions first articulated that providing an adequate education was a state responsibility, and then after that the state was responsible for paying for it. And here we are 20 years later, and these economic disparities still exist.
Yeah, we heard about the zip code effect from our earlier call out, the superintendent of Claremont. So what would the BIA like to see change?
Well, I know there's been some discussion about targeting aid, and to a certain extent that takes place in New Hampshire, but it's very limited because, first of all, New Hampshire is sending adequacy aid, a per-pupil amount, to all school districts, all towns, based on the number of students in those districts, and they get that adequacy aid doesn't change. Now, if there are districts that have a high percentage of students on free and reduced lunch, they get some additional amount, but it's not really very much, and it's not a very effective form of targeting, and the legislature has always felt hampered by targeting. I mean, most states around the country, this is not an issue. Everyone understands that there's a limited state resource, state funding, and that the most effective way of using it is to target it to those school districts or those towns that are most in fiscal need.
But what's the state hampered by from targeting better, as you seem to be saying, Dave?
Well, I think the belief is that the Claremont decisions require the state to send the same amount to per pupil amount to every town, regardless of the fiscal capacity of that town. Now, that's never, I don't believe, really been tested. But on top of that, though, there's a political reality, which is a lot of representatives, especially, but also senators, are from affluent towns, and there's always been a reluctance to pass anything that would minimize the amount of state aid going to those.
Yeah, we
communities.
Talked about spreadsheet wars earlier, so
yeah,
you probably caught
yeah.
that part. Although it seems like there is a fair bit of targeting going on, even if Claremont does hamper it to some extent, as you said. Steve Norton told us earlier, Bedford gets $2,000 per student from the state, and Berlin gets $9,000, so that sounds pretty targeted.
Yeah, but I think clearly it's not enough to alleviate the disparities that the Public Policy Center report has just made public, and I think it's really far less than what happens in other states, where some school districts might receive little or no aid from the state. So, yes, targeting is taking place, but it's hampered by the fact that so much of the state aid is going out in a per pupil amount
to everybody. No matter what. So the Business and Industry Association and others have long called for a constitutional amendment to sort of release the state from these restrictions that you talked about. But some property poor districts distrust that lawmakers will come through reliably. They worry that there'll be wild swings in education funding depending on the mood of the legislature that year. So, you know, not happy with the current system, but are a little worried what would happen if you just let lawmakers take control of it. I wonder how you feel about that, Dave.
Yeah, well, I think it's fair to say there are several hurdles in passing a constitutional amendment to give the legislature.
That's an understatement. Given what we've seen over the past 20 years.
It's difficult to do. You need 60% of the House and 60% of the Senate, and then 66 and two-thirds plus 1% of voters in the state. That's a very high hurdle. The second thing is, and you just alluded to it, I mean, let's face it, the legislature doesn't have a really great track record of keeping promises for education funding. There's a lot of people that say if the state had made its obligations or kept its word with the Augenblick formula, we would have been in this situation to begin with. So there is distrust that has been built up. And
so what's the solution, Dave, to what you just said, that the, you know, you understand the distrust. Lawmakers don't, to quote you, have a great track record. What's the solution to put them on track, so to speak, and make them stay there?
Well, I think the art to crafting a constitutional amendment, and we haven't been successful so far, is to try and find some wording that will provide both flexibility to the legislature and assurances to individuals that the legislature won't backtrack on its funding obligation. But we need to recognize that if we're really going to go down the targeting road, some communities, more affluent communities, may be getting less than what they're receiving now. And if we can't get over that, then we're not going to be successful in really coming up with a meaningful targeting program.
All right. Well, Dave, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Dave Juvay, Senior Vice President of the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. On the line from Manchester is Jim. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Good morning, folks. I love this discussion. I think it's a very important one. I think there's a New Hampshire, we look at this through New Hampshire lenses, and it's a very strange lens. And just, you know, when we look at the all-day kindergarten funding from last week, which I know is not the subject of today, and it's just so strange coming, if you look at it from the outside, that we would choose a gambling source to fund education. But let me go to the point that I wanted to make on this call, which is, in Manchester, we have the largest, you know, almost 10% of the children in the state of New Hampshire go
right
to school in Manchester's public schools. And yet, Manchester spends less per student than every other school district in the state. It has the highest percentage of free and reduced lunch. It's got the highest percentage of immigrant and refugee kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you look at the actual, talk about this zip code thing, if you look at the zip codes across the state of New Hampshire, there is a terrible link between poverty, lack of opportunity, and the money being spent in education. When you go to Newcastle, which is spending $30,000 per year per student, and you come to Manchester spending $12,000 per year per student, we go to Wyndham spending $15,000 or $16,000 per year per student, and the map of poverty and need exactly matches the map of funding in the school. So if you take off the rose-tinted glasses for a minute, the education system in the state of New Hampshire exacerbates and even contributes to the lack of opportunity and aggravates those lack of opportunities. So I think it's a very
Jim, yeah, and Steve Norton was talking about the map earlier, and you know it's so interesting, Steve, because and Jim, thank you for the call. In this country, you know, since Donald Trump was elected president, people have been talking more about, you know, rural economies, rural areas being left behind, being kind of ignored. And it sounds like what Jim is saying, what you said, is that this map in New Hampshire kind of reflects that.
Well, the map of New Hampshire really has three spots now. One is this swath of rural New Hampshire that's struggling, still in recession, experiencing demographic decline, and that's changing the conversation about education, and cities as well. You think about Manchester, the students moving out of Manchester into Bedford. You know, the system there, it's our queen city. I think that's another group of questions, policy questions. That city will not survive if it does not have good schools. People move to places where there are good schools. And so, you know, that's a big public policy question the legislature has to grapple with. If we want young people to move to our cities and people to live here, what should we be doing about the education system? Should we be doing something else?
Sure. And there's that the regenerative tissue and organ manufacturing institute coming to Manchester. Everybody's super excited about that. But where are those folks going to live? Are they going to live in Manchester?
Right.
Or are they going to choose to live elsewhere where the schools might be perceived as better? Gary?
I mean, we've seen over the what we haven't had is this massive in-migration that we used to have in this state in the 80s and 90s in particular. People aren't moving here. These young families aren't coming here anymore.
But they might to Manchester because
might,
of this institute.
But it's, I mean, it's a statewide problem. It's not just rural problem. It's well, a lot of the cities, too, are experiencing the same problem.
Wow. Go ahead, Steve. Did you want to jump back in?
It is an interesting question about what's going to happen over the next 10 to 15 years. We have seen a slight uptick in migration into New Hampshire over the last year. Does that grow and expand as the Massachusetts market gets tighter and rentals units get more expensive? Do people start moving to New Hampshire? We'll have to see.
Well, thank you for the call, Jim. I appreciate it. And another one, Sarah is calling in from where? Hi, Sarah. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I'm calling just to sort of echo what everyone's saying. I'm a 31-year-old teacher, so I'm considered a millennial. And I just got in a fairly new, within the last couple of years, teaching position in a district about 20 minutes away in which I received almost a $17,000 pay grade.
Wow, congratulations, Sarah.
Yeah, thanks. But that enabled me to buy a house. But the sort of ironic piece of that is that I cannot afford to live in the district that I teach in, which is a great school district, because I have student loans and I'm facing a lot of the economic struggles that many people in my age category are facing. So I am acutely aware that my 2-year-old son will be going to less funded and in a less rigorous school system. And I feel like if the state really wants to solve the problem of the increasing age and really wants younger people to move in, they really need to make education more equitable.
So Sarah, I don't know if you want to name names. So you live in where? Is that correct?
Yep. I live in where? Yes.
Okay. So your son will, go ahead. He'll go to where public schools basically.
Yes. So I used to teach in Raymond because we actually just moved out of Manchester into Ware.
Okay.
And I used to teach in Raymond and I now teach in Bow.
Okay. And that's a wealthy district and they pay their teachers really well. Yeah.
It's a wonderful, wonderful school district. And I will say that the teachers that I've met everywhere work very hard. And it's just a matter of schools being able to compensate educators at all levels.
Well, Sarah, it's really good to hear from you. Real interesting story. Seeing this, Steve Norton, on a couple different levels as a mom, as a teacher, and as a taxpayer.
Right. Well, what fascinates me is the notion that we always know that people want to move where good schools are. But I never really thought about the possibility that someone wouldn't move to New Hampshire because they can't live in Bow and have their kids go to Bow. So this is a workforce development question as well for bringing millennials in. I'm still trying to get my head around that.
Sure. I'm so glad she called. Thank you so much, Sarah. Go ahead, Gary.
It struck me as being this whole bigger problem with funding education, not just at the public school level, but higher education and everything in New Hampshire, where we have the highest student loan debt in the country because we don't we're the lowest aid to higher education in the country.
Well, here, thank you so much for the call, Sarah. Here's an email that came in that I really want to share because this person raises a point that we have not talked about, and it's an important one. This is from State Representative Joelle Martin in Milford, who says, in recent years, there has been an ongoing trend of downshifting additional school-related costs from the state to the local level. Examples, Joelle says, of downshifting have included teacher retirement costs, school building costs. Could your guest please comment on the impact of this downshifting on school budgets and ultimately local property taxpayer burdens? Thank you, Joelle, for the email. Gary, this is an important point because we've talked to a couple people and we've said, hey, shouldn't you get less money? You have fewer students. But this is something we haven't looked at, right, Gary? The
Right.
state used to kick in 20 years ago a lot more for these costs than it does now.
Yeah, I mean, school building aid used to pay for 60% of particularly regional school districts and then down to 30 or 40% for single school district buildings. I mean, and that hasn't been in place for a long time. We've restarted it, but we really haven't put any money into it.
Yeah, it was put off during the recession by Governor Lynch.
Right.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the teacher retirement costs.
That's a huge cost.
The state used to put in more money. Now they don't put any money toward it. And that really spiked a lot of school costs.
So when we look at this issue of, gee, you have fewer students, shouldn't you have, you know, lower costs? Joelle's making the point that there are other costs that the state used to pick up that it doesn't pick up anymore.
Right. So I wonder if the legislature will take all of these funding programs. I mean, Gary just talked about the new school building stabilization fund that the governor created. Are we going to take all these policy levers and see what we should be, how we should be using them to encourage the education system that we want? Do we want to support consolidation and in rural areas? Do we want to create more capacity in our urban areas? Do we do it with school building aid? Do we think about maybe funding some of those retirement costs to send those dollars back to local communities? I think those are all going to be questions that hopefully will get rolled into the broader question that the committees are going to be dealing with on education.
What do you guys make of the fact that there are two committees now looking at this? What do you think?
So Commissioner Edelblue is really focused on operational questions, I think. He's bringing in superintendents and business administrators to really think about the business model of schools.
And he has a business
that's
background.
That's his background and that's his approach. The legislature is really going to, I think Representative Kirk, who's chairman of the Finance Committee, said, we're not thinking about putting deck chairs away or back on the deck. We're just looking to see about reshuffling them. So money and how we distribute it probably will be up for conversation, but no material big change.
Wow. Okay. Well, just like you found over the past 20 years since Claremont. Thank you both, guys, very much for coming in. Gary, it's wonderful to see you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Good to be back.
Gary Reyno, author of Distant Dome, A Manchester Ink Link, an in-depth NH.org column about state news. And Steve, congratulations on the report, and thank you also.
Thanks so much.
Steve Norton, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our interns, Alana Pearson and Edie Allard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.